welcome to the second hour of Shattering Myths. Scott, who's the producer of the program, and I were having a conversation over the break in terms of the nature of Satan and how he came to be in the position that he is in. And I thought it was interesting enough, and I'm sure that there are listeners who would like to understand this dynamic between Yahweh and Satan, that I thought maybe we'd just speak a little bit about it in this part of the program. And so let's kind of set the scene for what has transpired. And it's important in that if you understand Satan's mindset, if you understand his motivations, then you understand Islam. And understanding Islam is really important as it relates to knowing what's going to happen in our world going forward. Muslims are going to unite in the one thing that unites them, which is their hatred of Jews, to attack Israel en masse. And that's going to launch, according to Yahweh, World War III. And so it is that war is the first phase that's going to lead to the deaths of one out of every four people on the planet, and then a third of those who remain. So half the people on the planet are going to die as a consequence of this war. So it's a very important thing to understand. And, of course, it has more influence over world events than does anything else. So understanding Islam is only possible when you understand Satan. So we're going to talk a little bit about Satan. Now, also, understanding Satan helps you understand Christianity. You see, Paul, in his second letter to the Corinthians, told us specifically what the thorn in his side was. So it's actually a goad. It's the in Acts, the third time that he depicts, and each time he has a little different variation of what happened on the road to Damascus. The third time he has this flashing light, say it is difficult to kick against the goad. That line is from Dionysus, the Roman Bacchus, the son of the sun in pagan mythology. And the goad is a prod, is a sharp stick that is used to control dumb animals. And so when you understand the mentality of the goad and its relationship to Satan, his view of I need something to control the dumb animal that is humanity, and the fact that Paul quoted Satan's line in his alleged conversion experience on the road to Damascus. And then later in the second letter to Corinth, Paul says that goad in my side, that thorn in my side, that sharp pointer in my side is a messenger from Satan. So Christians will sit there and debate and say, I wonder what the thorn in Paul's side was. Well, he answers the question. Just read the rest of the statement. He says it's the messenger from Satan. He was demon-possessed. So if you want to understand Christianity and their creation of a new God, the Lord Jesus Christ, Lord is really important because Lord is the term that Yahweh uses to describe Satan. You see, Satan wants to lord over and control men. Yah has no interest in any of those things. That's why he never uses Lord in connection with himself. So if you want to understand the nature of Pauline Christianity, if you want to understand Islam, you need to understand Satan. So let's take a moment and think about who Satan is, what's his agenda, what's his nature. All right. So with that perspective, God created Malach, that's the Hebrew term. There is no such thing as an angel. An angel is a transliteration of the Greek word for messenger. Agelos is the Greek word for messenger. It is agelos is the translation of the Hebrew Malach, which means messenger. God created messengers. They're envoys. He refers to them as Shabbat. Now, Shabbat is a very interesting term. It's translated, and it's not even, I put translated in quotes because it's really not a translation, but it's translated as host in your English Bibles. But what Shabbat actually conveys is a command and control regimen. It's like the military. In the military, you have ranks. and all of those who enlist in the military follow orders. Well, you don't enlist in the ranks of the Malak. You were created for a special role. They are Yahweh's emissaries, his envoys, his messengers that are controlled via orders. They have no free will. But, you know, in the military, you can choose to reject an order. You can choose to do something that is the opposite of what you were told to do, but there's an immediate consequence. You're either demoted, you are killed in some cases, or you're imprisoned. So the same thing is true in with the Shaba, with the messengers. They have no free will, so there's an immediate consequence for rebelling. And so this is the Malak aren't these fuzzy little pretty winged girls that are all lovey-dovey. It's impossible for a Malak to love. You see, without free will, you can't love. It's impossible for a Malak to be creative. That's why every one of Satan's religions is a counterfeit. They are not creative. They cannot love. They were created without free will to do what God ordered them to do. They are timeless. So in one aspect, as energy-based entities, in other words, they would appear as light. As energy-based entities, they're vastly beyond what we are in physical form. Because in physical form, you have to multiply matter by the speed of light squared to equal the same amount of energy. And so they are vastly superior to us in that they are energy-based as opposed to physical. But we are vastly superior to them in that we were conceived with free will. And with free will and with a conscience, this gift that God gave us of being able to discern right from wrong, true from false, good from bad, we have the ability to understand the mind of God and also free will to be able to choose to love, to create, to reject, to hate, all of those possibilities. All right, so you've got this command and control regimen, no free will of Satan. And now God creates them to do his bidding, lots of things. You know, being God's a big job. And so he has his Malak do the things he wants done. And now he creates man. And that was the whole purpose of the creation of the universe, was to create a being with free will, with a nesama that could think, that could respond morally and rationally, that could choose to engage in a relationship with him. God wanted to grow. He wanted to be infinite. And he can't be infinite unless he grows. And the only way that God, who has everything in the universe, can grow is through relationships. And so he created man, and he begins to doubt over man. Not doubt in this, but to focus on man, to care for man, to nurture man, to enjoy his time with man. And so God is devoting all of his energy and resources to enjoying this relationship with his creation, with man, who was put in a position to choose to embrace him or reject him, therefore could genuinely choose to love him. And this messenger, this Malak, Halal bin Shakar, which is his name, said, well, what in the world? This is this inferior creature. It's so inferior to us. And yet God is spending all of his time with this inferior creature. In fact, he's even taking on physical form to walk and talk with this creature by the very fact that he is so enamored with this inferior creature, it makes him inferior.
Could it also have been some jealousy? Not only is this creature, does he see this creature as inferior, but this creature gets to do whatever he wants to do. He's free to go do whatever he wants to do, and then he sees the one thing that he thought it was superior to him. Now all of a sudden, with this person that is, you know, that he sees as inferior, which then would also lead to him feeling that maybe God's inferior too, so maybe I should take his place, which, you know, is maybe something like that.
I would agree with all of that. I think it's brilliant. Yes, absolutely. I can't even add to it. Yes, absolutely. And so what does Halal bin Shakar, Satan, do? He makes a choice. Doesn't have free will. So he's not given this opportunity, but he makes a choice. Immediate consequence. He says, I am greater than God. And he gets a number of the Moloch to follow him. I am greater than God. And so from that point on, God says, oh, okay, well, there's that direct consequence. You don't have free will. You weren't given the opportunity to make that choice. So there's an immediate consequence. You're drummed out of the core. You are now the adversary. And so what does Satan spend his entire time doing? He thinks he knows that he can't confront God directly. He's not going to go there and say, all right, what we're going to do here, God, is you and I are going to duke it out. That would like be going with a pea shooter with maybe a spit wad and saying, I want to go against a cruise missile. But 1,000,000,000,000 times greater than that. So he's not going to duke it out with God. So what can he do to get back at God, to hurt God, who has not only rejected him, but now cast him out of the core?
Take the thing that he spent all this time and energy and something that he wants to eventually love and corrupt it.
Correct. And that's exactly what he does. Now, did God know he was going to do that? Absolutely. Why didn't God stop it? Because it was actually part of his plan. Now, why would you say that? Now, why would God allow this repulsive entity to go corrupt the very thing that he loves? What do you think?
Because now, all of a sudden, now everybody that does find him is now truly made the choice to find him. Now, you have all these other things that you could do. If you were just sitting in the, if we were sitting in the Garden of Eden still,
yeah.
Whatever the program name is.
Right, you're sitting there, God's telling you stories about how he created all of these animals and life, and you're having this wonderful camp out in a perfect environment with a perfect God.
What choice is there? If you saw him every day, there'd be no choice.
Correct. And so there had to be a compelling alternative. Otherwise, you're really not making the choice to engage with God in a relationship, a loving family relationship. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back in a moment. Back to Shattering Myths. We're having a discussion this morning about the nature of Hasatan. Hasatan is the adversary in Hebrew. The adversary's name, according to Yahweh, is Halal ben Shakar. Shakar, the ben is, of course, Hebrew for son of. Shakar is the rising sun. The sun has been the preeminent metaphor, guise for Satan. He is as Ra, as Amen Ra. He was worshipped in Egypt as Bel and Baal. The sun was worshipped in Babylon and by the Canaanites and by the Assyrians. Bel and Baal mean Lord. As the god of the Greeks and the Romans, he was worshipped as, like for example, as Apollo, as Zeus, in the guise of the sun. So his name is Halal ben Shakar. Halal speaks of arrogance and corruption. So arrogant and corrupt, son of the rising sun, is Hasatan, which means the adversary's name. Satan is not the devil's name, it is his title, as is Lord. Lord being describing his mentality. Now, the reason we're having this discussion is because when you come to understand what Satan's motivations are and what his abilities and limitations are, then you understand how he operates in religion and in politics and how he goes about corrupting, and you can come, perhaps for the first time, to genuinely understand Pauline Christianity and Mohammedan Islam. It becomes easy under those circumstances. or at least easier. So moving back to Hasatan. He is now rebelled. He's taken a number of Malak, which we now refer to as demons, with him. And he is angry at God. And the only way that he can, this is from his perspective, hurt God, lash back out at God, is to do that. One is to get man to see him as God and to corrupt man so that he is no longer something that God can love. So if he takes man and corrupts him so that that God can no longer love him, and then if he gets man to worship him as God, to see him as God, then he will have done everything he can to lash back at Yahweh, who is God. Now, God knew this was going to occur. God explained the reason why it was allowed. And then the first episode we have with Hasatan is so symbolic of everything that he would do forever through religion and politics. And it answers so many questions as to why the Yah's testimony has been so corrupted by religious institutions in their publications and their translations. Yahweh allowed Hasatan to enter the garden. Now, that means that there's limitations on him on what he can and cannot do. But God specifically said, I'm going to allow you into the garden. And into the garden, God also allowed Satan to corrupt his testimony. Now, Christians will say, you know, when I tell them that their Bible translations are hopelessly errant, they say, I can't believe that God would allow anyone to corrupt his word. And yet, you read the first story of Satan in the garden, and there is God allowing Satan to do that very thing. He takes something that God said out of context, twists it, and uses it to beguile Chawa, which is the actual name of Adam's wife. Chawa means life. And collectively, both Adam and Chawa are beguiled by Satan, counterfeiting, twisting, bastardizing, perverting, corrupting God's testimony. Taking something God said out of context, misquoting him, and then twisting it to infer something that was not true. Now, look at what happens in religion. What did Paul do? If you read Paul's letters, he takes things that Yahweh said out of their context. He misquotes him. And then he twists the results to create the illusion that the opposite of what God said is true. Every ploy that Paul uses throughout his letters follows that exact same scheme that Satan used in the garden. What did Muhammad do with Islam? He claimed that he was confirming the Torah. And he takes bits and pieces of the Torah, prophets and Psalms, out of context, misquotes what was said, and then twist it to create the exact opposite understanding. That's the nature of religion. Satan has no creativity, so all he can do is counterfeit. You don't have to have any creativity to corrupt, to twist, to pervert. And so now you understand the nature of religion. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Mist. We're talking about Hasatan. Halal bin Shakar is his God-given name. His nature, his limitations, his ambitions. The more you understand about this unique creature, this Malak, this former envoy of Yahweh, the easier it is for you to understand the religions of Christianity and Islam and how they work. If we were to look at the tally of the game since that encounter with Chawa and Adam in the Garden of Eden, it's the Gan Eden, it's a protective enclosure of great joy translated out of the Hebrew. And we would look at mankind today and recognize that 99.999% of mankind either completely ignore Yahweh, have no relationship with him at all, or they actually worship Satan as if he were God. And so you would look at the numbers of Muslims and Christians and socialist secular humanists, and your first inclination would be that Satan has won. He has corrupted man to make men and women unlovable. And he has beguiled them into viewing him as God. So they may be vastly different in terms of power and influence, but Satan appears to have won, hasn't he?
Not at all. When he originally created man, he created one. He created just one man, and he was perfectly fine with that. And then he created Chawa. Not because he wanted to create Chawa, because he looked at Adam and he said, you know, I think he wants this, you know.
I think he'd be happier with this.
I think he'd be happier with this. So therefore...
Which tells you everything you'd ever want to know about God, doesn't it?
Exactly.
God was satisfied with just Adam, but God, in loving Adam, recognized, you know, I think he will be even happier if I create a companion for him.
Which
and he did.
And he probably saw the happiness in Adam, and then he thought, well, if he gets in here, then they can go out and they can have, you know, more people will come. But for him, it was only one. He only needed one. And
right.
And frankly, in his mind, he's already won. He's got, you know, Moshe, Dode, all those people that are already with him, already part of his covenant, and so he's won in his mind.
God got everything that he wanted out of the creation of the universe. He was satisfied with just having one loving relationship with Adam. He got Adam and Chawa. Both of them are presented later in the Babrashith account as choosing to embrace Yah. He has Noah and his family. He has Enoch and Elijah. He has Abraham and Sarah and Yishak and Jacob. And on and on the list goes. God was satisfied with one, was happy as a lark with two, and now he has thousands of children that he can devote his energy and time and teaching and love to.
And he still, in the beauty of it all, is that he still leaves it open. You know, you come, more people can come. I have plenty of room.
Right.
Come, you know.
All right. Yeah. The house is big.
The house is big.
My heart is big.
Exactly. And that's pretty astounding when you think about it.
Yes, absolutely. So the reality is that God does not love every human that is born. He doesn't even know the vast preponderance of humans that are born. And God etched in stone that he recognized that would be only thousands amongst the billions who would come this way, who would avail themselves of his mercy, who would embrace his covenant and its benefits. And so he knew this all along, and he's quite satisfied with that. It is God created this entire universe to be dad with his children and to spend eternity doing what he and Adam did. You know, we're given a glimpse into what our eternity is going to be like when Yahweh walked in the garden with Adam. And when he sat down with Adam and said, "Hey, look at these things. Let's come up with names for these things. Let's use our words to describe life, and camping out together, learning together, just growing together, enjoying one another's company, is what eternity is going to be like. We're going to go off and explore not only this universe, but the new one that God is going to create, this time with us being witnesses. And just as he did in the garden, explaining the nature of life and the beauty of life in his creation with Adam, he's going to do with that with us throughout time. So therefore, in this one story, you come to know the purpose of creation, our purpose, why we were conceived, to have a enjoyable, personal, family-oriented relationship with God. And you understand HaSatan's, the adversary, Satan's, Halal bin Shakar's capabilities and motives. What he's going to do through religion, through politics, is going to corrupt God's testimony. He's going to take it out of context, the Christian, the New Testament, and he's going to twist it and pervert it. That's why our translations are so corrupt. And through that is going to convey an entirely different message. Yes, in Christianity, God dies, man kills him. Then God comes back to life, just like the sun gods of old. And that if you just believe, that would be sufficient. And what is the belief in? It's in the gospel of grace and pagan goddesses. You can ignore all of God's Torah teaching, even though the Torah is the only place where God introduces himself to mankind. The Torah is the only place where God presents the terms and conditions of his covenant relationship. It's the only place he presents the benefits of that covenant relationship. And yet Satan, through Christianity, through Islam, would have a vast preponderance of people living in this world completely ignore his guidance. So Satan has prevailed with the vast preponderance of people. But in seeing this example of knowing who he is and what he can do, you at least are in a better position to understand human institutions. By the way, one of the things that's interesting about this whole story is that by allowing Satan to slither into the garden, it does demonstrate that Satan cannot be omnipresent. He can't be everywhere at once. So many religious people blame Satan for everything that goes bad in their lives and for all the negative influence. Satan has nothing to do with it. You know, big picture stuff, yeah, he's probably involved in. But in terms of average individual, he could care less. He looks at people as being rubbish. That's why he's in Islam. It's death and destruction. That's why people are so demeaned.
Animals.
Yeah. Animals.
He sees them as animals. That's why you see the stick to prod the animal.
That's right. That's the reason why the goat is in Paul's breath, not once but twice, when he speaks of being demon-possessed and also when he speaks of being controlled.
I think that makes this, that, as I'm sitting here listening, that makes this so amazing to me is that not only did Yahweh allow all that stuff to happen, but he then also assured that his the covenant would only be filled with people that used the gifts that he gave them.
Yes.
Your Nesalma and all that. It would be all stuff that you have to use reason. You have to have choices in order to know if you're using the right chain of thought and things like that.
Right. Yeah, Yahweh gave us a number of things. The first was mortal life, which we then can choose to use to determine whether or not we want to come to know him and engage in a relationship with him. He gave us a Nesalma, which is a conscience, which enables us to differentiate between that which is trustworthy and that which is not, that which is good, that which is bad, evil, for example. And he gave us free will so that we could choose between these things. But, you know, that wasn't really the end of the gifts. He also gave us his Torah, which is his teaching, his guidance, his roadmap, so that by observing it, we could come to know him, we could use those other gifts to come to know him, and we could understand what he's offering and choose to accept it or reject it.
I see that more as a tool, a map, if you will. Because, granted, the Torah is there, it's there. But it and anybody can pick it up.
Yeah.
But not everybody chooses to, and that's where I see it as a tool.
Yeah, you know, I think it is a tool in the sense that, you know, Masayah means a tool during the work of Yah. So and Yosha means Yahweh saves. So he's using that tool. And tool is a wonderful metaphor. This particular tool, as it relates to the Torah, though, is like Yosha himself, in that this tool also represents God. The Torah is God in our world.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like finding his journal, I guess. You know,
yeah.
I know him. Right here it is. Here's everything I've written. You know, I've written everything you need.
Right. But it's even beyond that, because he conceived the language of Hebrew. Hebrew is the only language where verbs aren't stuck in time, where all verbs have a relational component to them, and where most verbs are granted this volitional aspect. And so the words of his Torah literally represent him. They are the words of the Torah are God's presence in our lives, in our world.
I guess where we differ on this is that you said the gifts were something that he gave to everybody, and while he will allow everybody to pick up the Torah, not everybody will actually use it.
Yeah, so that's correct. But we're not even disagreeing here.
Yep.
Because God gave every human the gift of life, of a conscience. So life is the soul, our consciousness, the nesama, which is nefesh in Hebrew, the nesama, which is our conscience, which is our ability to exercise good judgment, and free will to operate. If God is represented by his Torah, if the Torah is a tool, yes, but it is literally the living presence of Yahweh in our midst, that the words in the Torah represent him in our world, then he is as he would intend it to be, which is that he's in our world for all of those who wish to embrace him, who wish to come to know him, who wish to engage with him. But that same Torah can be rejected, just as God himself can be rejected. So it's there for you to approach him, but it's also there in such a way that if you choose to ignore him or reject him or oppose him, you can do so. But that will change one day. And we will speak of the change in terms of the relationship between the Torah and our lives when we return to the final segment of Shattering Myths after the break. It is a very profound thought, and I hope you join us in the final segment. To the final segment of Shattering Myths today. We've been talking about the role that Satan plays in religion and politics, and coming to understand his influence so that you can understand the nature of religion in particular. And then we migrated to the gifts of God, which are mortal life, a conscience, a nesama, the ability to exercise good judgment, and free will. And then I was speaking about there is another gift, and we were differentiating between that gift, which is the Torah, which is God's introduction to us, where he introduces himself to us, and where he presents his covenant relationship to us, so that we can choose to embrace or reject its terms and conditions, and therefore either receive or not receive its benefits. And so we were differentiating that from the other gifts. And a couple things struck me in that discussion. One is that it is true that the Torah stands apart from the other gifts, and that the first three gifts are given to everybody. The Torah isn't given to everybody. It's there. It's available for everybody, just like God is there. He's available to anyone who chooses to engage in a relationship with him, so long as they do so under his terms. But it's still something we must choose to study, something we must choose to embrace, something we must choose to act upon. You know, we don't choose to act upon. Life is given to us. We don't choose to have a nesama. It's given to us, a conscience. We don't choose free will. It's given to us. But the Torah is available. It's not actually given to everyone, but it's available to everyone. Now, what's really interesting is that when Yirmiyahu ascribed Yahweh's proclamation regarding the renewal of his covenant, and in Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah 31, is the presentation of that. And God says, you know, I am going to reaffirm my covenant relationship with Yehudim and with Yisrael. Yehuda means those individuals who relate to and are related to Yah, and Yisrael means individuals who engage and endure with God. So I am going to renew, I'm going to restore my relationship, which means the relationship with the vast preponderance of Yehudim and Yisrael is severed at the moment. But he said, I'm going to restore it. I'm going to reaffirm it. And he says, this reaffirmation, this restoration of this relationship is not going to be exactly the same as the one that I had with Abraham, with Yishak, and with Jacob. Now, with that, God gave them those three gifts and offered them five more, the benefits of the covenant, if they chose to listen to his teaching, which is what Torah means, and act upon his guidance, which is what Torah means. But in his return, the one thing that's going to be different is rather than the Torah being a gift that's available to us but not actually given to us, when he returns and reaffirms his covenant, the Torah is going to be given to all who survive his return. God's going to literally write his Torah inside of us. And the reason he can't do that now is if he were to do that now, he would obliterate the benefit of free will and choice. Then he would put himself, because he is represented by the words of the Torah, he'd be putting himself in everyone. He'd be literally writing his name, as he says he's going to do upon his return, on our hearts. And therefore, there would be no free will. Everyone would belong to him. But God doesn't want that. He wants us to choose this relationship. And when he returns, those who have chosen to engage in the relationship, they're going to be given the gift of the Torah. God's teaching is going to be placed inside of us all. Now, the last thought I want you to think about here is that we've migrated from Satan, the adversary, to the Torah. But really, this is the same topic, because the only antidote for evil, for the corruption of the adversary, is the Torah. Listen to God's statement here in Masal Word Pictures, Proverbs 28:4. The wicked, those who pervert and twist, arrogantly boasting and making fools of themselves, those who pretend to be bright and enlightened and yet display an improper attitude of haughtiness, glorifying themselves, do so by abandoning and rejecting the Torah. Paul, Christianity, Islam, Muhammad, socialist secular humanism, abandoning and rejecting the Torah. And God says, and those who observe, focusing upon the Torah, those who closely examine and carefully consider the Torah, God's teaching and direction, they take the initiative to oppose them. The initiative, the ability to oppose Satan is the Torah. The motivation for religion is the absence of the Torah. I'm Yada. This has been Shattering Myths. Join us, please, tomorrow.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of...